Hey everybody, Dave Hodges here, host of the Common Sense Show. Thank you for joining us. We are the show that is freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. The question that we're wrestling with now collectively is how do we free ourselves from the current administration that's insisting on running this country into the ground no matter what. And they're exposed. They're fully exposed. And before we go to our guest, I just wanted just to share this little tidbit with you I just came across. 80% of swing voters are saying that this administration is clueless, out of touch, taking us in the wrong direction. They got 7 months to self-correct, or it's going to be a bloodbath. I don't even know if they can steal enough votes to make a difference in how the tide has turned. But anyway, I just thought I would bring that up. Our guest today is Susan Bradford, and we're going to be talking about a couple of people who I've really centered on, one positively and one I've said, beware, she's a Trojan horse. And we'll see what Susan has to say about Tulsi Gabbard and Ron DeSantis. We're going to go there. Before we do, though, we've got to take care of a little business. And ladies and gentlemen, I warned you, they were going to tighten the noose with the food. They're tightening the noose with the food. The latest catastrophe out of 23 that I have listed is fertilizer. And I'm telling you right now, you need to get as much food as you can and get out of their system as quickly as you can and as completely as you can and for as long as you can, and pray there's divine intervention or some other intervention that will interrupt what they're doing. Unless you like to eat bugs, fake lab meat, it's going to get ugly. So storable food is where it's at. MPS has not raised their prices. Can you believe that? They haven't raised their prices. And ladies and gentlemen, they have a sale. So it's the same deal, 2,000 calories per day. You want to check them out, go to preparewithdave.com. That's preparewithdave.com. And if you have food, you darn well better have water. And we're looking at, if Putin takes the grid down, you're going to have to scavenge. A lot of you will not have access to water if that happens. So you're going to have to scavenge. There's plenty of water available in our environments. It's just you can't drink it unless you treat it. And the Alexa Pure Pro Water Filter does that. We recommend having three of them. As we say, what is it? Three is two, two is one, one is none. And we have three in our family because things get broken, things get lost, things get stolen, and you need to have a way to purify water. And they'll have research there if you go to waterwithdave.com, and you can see how they compare to the competition, which is very favorable. And actually, it's more than favorable. It's almost dominant. And they have a sale on as well. They haven't raised prices. So we're fortunate that these two vendors are holding the line on pricing, because I don't think very many other entities are. So you get the food, preparewithdave.com. You get the water, waterwithdave.com. And finally, last thing, and this will clear the slate here for this show, kind of like the British, we're doing our commercials right up front. I'm telling people right now, only keep in the bank what you can afford to lose. I'm not projecting a catastrophe, but the storm clouds are there. And to say that they're not there would be to ignore reality. And I'm not saying it's 1929, but I'm also saying it's not. And I'm saying I would err on the side of caution, and I would keep operating capital in the bank, and I would diversify, diversify, diversify. I would gold-proof my IRAs and 401ks. If I were you, I would try a little bit of Bitcoin. I would try some gold and silver. I would diversify into assets that have held their value through time. And do not trust the bank. After all, when you put your money in the bank, the courts have declared you're an unsecured creditor, and they own the money. So they're under no legal obligation to give it back to you. So what do you do? Well, you can call Noble Gold and do what I did. I went in from just being an advertiser at one time to where I'm now a customer. We're doing something again just today. Believe it or not, we're doing it today. We're making another adjustment, and I would suggest you do the same thing. If you have a nest egg to protect and you don't have to be a millionaire, I would call Noble Gold for low-pressure advice. Now, if you don't want to talk to anybody initially, you can have them send you material and just go to goldbeforelate.com. That's goldbeforelate.com, and they'll send you free material. They will not even call you. You'll have to contact them. They're trained to be passive. And if you want to talk to someone immediately, call 877-646-5347. That's 877-646-5347. And please note, the advertising that we're bringing you here on the Common Sense Show, I hope you never need it. But given the gravity of the times right now, I'm afraid you might. And so all of our advertising, and we turned down about 90% of what we're offered to advertise, but we try to stay to what we fear or know that our listening audience is going to need. So please, please take this to heart and prep, because if you go knocking on doors when the crisis comes, you're not going to find very many people who are willing or even able to help you. So I would recommend right now, preparation should become your number one endeavor after taking care of your family and your job. Well, Susan Radford has a very interesting background in journalism, and she has interviewed some of the more, I don't want to use the word notorious or infamous, but she's interviewed some people of note and some people who the middle class of this country would not describe as their friend. And she's also been involved with some big, she's rubbed elbows with some of the rich and powerful in Europe as well. And she had a stint with CBS News. And Susan, I want to welcome you to the show. And for the listening audience that is growing here as we expand into new venues, tell people a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you so much for having me today, David.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. I am a journalist who serves the public interest. I went into journalism, you know, wanting to be a foreign correspondent or possibly working in international foreign diplomacy. And I ended up doing my master's degree in England in international relations at the University of Essex. And while I was there, I founded the European Review, which was a departmental publication for the Center for European Studies. That enabled me to kind of work with some of the European elite, both to interview them, to solicit their manuscripts and publish like their perspective on where they were taking the European Union. Concurrently, I worked for the Atlantic Council of the UK as senior research fellow and representative on the NATO Universities Advisory Committee. And then when I graduated, I worked as a speechwriter for the UK Shadow Foreign Secretary. So I was able to kind of like, you know, during that time, I was able to work within the British establishment to get a sense of where they were taking the world, how they applied their strategies, what their networks were. And I have endeavored to kind of use that knowledge in the public interest, like to help the people understand what is happening to them and why, like to arm them with information that can empower them. And I know you mentioned some of the more notorious people I've interviewed. Among them were, for example, Jack Abramoff, the most notorious super lobbyist who bought Capitol Hill during the Bush administration, and Baron Robert Rothschild, who established the European Common Market. A few highlights.
That's more than most people accomplish in a lifetime. That's really impressive. What was your main takeaway before we go to our topic? I just wonder, what was your main takeaway about the character and direction that the people who are running Europe wanted to take the continent?
They wanted, and this was back in the late 1990s, but they wanted more tighter European control through the European institutions, further European integration. They were building a TAFTA through an initiative called the New Atlantic Initiative, which was endorsed by Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Schmidt, and Henry Kissinger. This was to merge the European Common Market with NAFTA, like to build a bridge to forming a TAFTA, and then like they were kind of integrating the various economic markets throughout the world. And they also were very keen on bringing Turkey into the European Union. And I didn't understand why at the time they were trying to do that, because Turkey is Muslim and Europe is Judeo-Christian. And they, you know, of course Turkey was a strategic ally of NATO, but it wasn't, you know, culturally in sync with Europe. And as I've discovered since, part of their strategy for bringing in Turkey into the European Union was part to conquer Europe. You know, they wanted to kind of overwhelm the social safety net and essentially force Europe to adopt Islam, you know, to be conquered by Islam, which is a strategic partner of the Vatican.
Wow. That's a mouthful. Who do they serve? If you were to say they really are beholden to a group, what would that group be?
The group would be the international bankers, I think. We're talking about the Rothschilds in particular, and the black nobility whose power is concentrated around the Vatican.
Yes, and I wouldn't describe them as a friend of the people.
No, they're not. These are people, they were a predatory merchants whose power goes back centuries. They aligned with the mercenary forces. You know, today we have Blackwater. Back in the day, they had Turkish, Khazarian, and Mongolian warriors who would conquer territories for them. And they worked with intelligence networks. And governments to essentially to kind of their modus operandi was to overthrow governments, to kill as many people as they could within those territories, enslave the rest, seize the natural resources, and then establish some type of market dominance in those areas. And they used the government as a weapon against the people to kind of extract wealth from them that was not used to like to invest and reinvest in those societies, but that wealth was redirected to themselves. So essentially, they were, they were enslaving the people and I guess using the people as a human resource. And their objective was to keep the people at a subsistence level. Independency, so they would have enough resources and wealth to reproduce, to make a very basic living. And beyond that, they were dependent upon the elites whom they served and who were extracting revenue from them.
Wow.
That's a tactic that they've continued today. The pattern was established centuries ago. And so that the multinationals that have stemmed from that, you know, which are controlled interlocking boards of directors, go all the way back to those early merchants. So they are, you know, controlling the corporate landscape today, and through money, you know, campaign finance, money and politics, they're able to, you know, control our government.
Okay, that's that matches with an interview I just did last night. That's very, very interesting the way you put that. Not much room for the little guy. It's kind of like, shut up, peasant, get in line.
The system is unfortunately rigged in favor of them and against we the people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Well, let's turn our attention to the subjects at hand. And I'm going to let you choose. We're going to talk about DeSantis and Gabbert. And which one would you like to start with?
Well, we could, you know, start with DeSantis if you'd like.
Okay, I think that's an easier one to do.
Okay. Okay, so with DeSantis, now I generally like DeSantis. There are some noteworthy aspects about how he is governing that I think are worth, you know, calling out. One is that while he has championed, you know, Judeo-Christian values like transgender swim athletes. Competing against girls, you know, who are taking their their scholarships away from them, and he has worked against mask mandates. The fact of the matter is that according to the Vatican and to the elite, we are already living in a post-pandemic world. So I don't think, you know, I think that those concessions are you know, they're good for show. They appease the people and feed the base, but I don't think they're very substantive. You know, and of course, you know, the average person may not be in favor of, you know, of bringing, you know, transgender candidates into athletics programs where they have a biological advantage, you know, against, you know, women in particular, where men would have a biological advantage against women. I think those are red herrings. And there are topics around which people can become mobilized, but also distracted.
Yes,
you know, from the wider issue. So the one issue that kind of that caught my eye with DeSantis is that he negotiated one of the most historic, largest, most historic, and lucrative casino compacts with the Seminole Tribe of Florida. Now, that compact was struck down, I believe, by the courts. What it had intended to do is to expand sports betting throughout the state, and I believe that the courts blocked that as gaming was intended to be, for the tribe anyway, was intended to be confined to the reservations, and they wanted to, to dominate the state. But the tribes are a means through which the deep state has projected itself into the nation and into its institution. It was a means through which social democracy was brought into the United States. In particular, the Seminole Tribe of Florida, its original gaming operations were funded by a group associated with Meyer Lansky. I don't know if you're familiar with him, Dave, but he was, you know who that is.
He was, my book, in Jim Marr's book, he was part of the Kennedy assassination.
Interesting.
And he fixed the Chicago election so Kennedy could get elected in Cook County.
That's interesting. He was also a key figure in the International Crime Syndicate. He was working with George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, on CIA missions against Fidel Castro. And he was also connected to Tibor Rosenbaum, who had established Resorts International in Atlantic City. Tibor Rosenbaum was heavily connected to the Mossad, the CIA, and that Resorts International was also bankrolled by David Rockefeller and Baron Edmund de Rothschild. So you have those forces kind of coalescing around Resorts International, and then based upon the casinos that were developing and flourishing within Atlantic City, Meyer Lansky was able to corral some of that money and establish the bingo operations within Florida. The early bingo operations kind of set the stage for Jeffrey Epstein, because they used that money to kind of compromise and bribe judges and other elected officials, to do the bidding of the tribe. And that practice has continued to this day. The great wealth that has been created in Indian country, it was meant to be be invested within Indian country to finance their government, to provide for the schools and medical care, health care, and for the needs of the Indians. But as is the case, for those who've studied Indian country, Indians remain very poor. So where is the money going? And the money is being used to capitalize big business. It was used to finance the mergers and acquisitions departments of Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. It's invested in the schools and the governments, the courts. So essentially, the tribes are a means through which the deep state can kind of pour money into the society at large and then control its institutions. Now, I'm sure DeSantis isn't thinking along those lines. He probably is expecting that the greater, the more prosperous the Seminole tribe is, the more money that he could raise for his party and for himself. But the fact is that the Florida state legislature has rejected casino gambling in Florida for many years, for decades. The people are opposed to it, and yet casino gambling flourishes throughout Florida and throughout the country at large, with the precedent having been set in Florida. The original bingo operations were used as a template and the precedent for all the hundreds of casinos that were established throughout the country, and most of those casinos were funded by money from the Indian Claims Commission, the millions of dollars that were given to the tribes in exchange for the land that was lost to the ancestors of those tribal members. So the money was intended for the Indians, but was instead corralled into the tribal councils, used for casinos, and the casinos in turn have been used to kind of bankroll the deep state, to bankroll the big banks, who in turn have become reckless with our money. They've used that money, to create private equity funds, like a Carlyle Group is one of the private equity funds that kind of emerged from these tribal operations. To buy up our real estate, to engage in, kind of reckless real estate investments. And they've done a tremendous amount of damage to the middle class and to the country at large. And again, I'm sure that DeSantis isn't thinking along those lines. He may not even be aware of you know, the danger that these tribes pose or the corruption that they bring with them. But the fact remains that he negotiated one of the most historic, one of the largest gaming compacts in history with the Seminole Tribe of Florida. And I believe that he wouldn't have done that had he not been under the political influence of that tribe and received money from that tribe. So he's essentially doing their bidding, which makes him, you know, in my opinion, anyway, somewhat compromised.
Hmm. Is this, in your view, is it unethical what he's done?
I think it isn't unethical. I know it's par for the course in politics. It happens. What he did is many other governors are doing within their own states. But I believe that it is unethical because the bigger and more powerful these tribes become, the more power they wield within the state and the more money they're able to extract from it by way of lobbying. So they're able to generate more government contracts for themselves. We know from our own research, these tribes are not working within the national interest. They're working on behalf of the Vatican and the Rothschilds, which control them. And so I think if he were truly serving the interests of the people, he would be curtailing, you know, casino gambling. He would be protecting the people from the crime that, you know, that is promoted, you know, through the expansion of gaming. But I think he could be looking at the amount of money that stands to be made, and if he can secure, you know, millions to billions of dollars from as a cut from those operations, he can ensure that the Floridians don't have to shoulder, high of a level of taxes as they might otherwise. So he might help curb the taxes that they might have to absorb otherwise. But I do think that it is unethical, and it's reflecting that he's part of the pay to play game, which I think most leaders are. And I suspect had he not been willing to do what he did, he likely would never have become the governor of Florida to begin with. So I think it was a decision that was made in his own personal self-interest to help him, you know, pursue his political ambitions. And by serving these interests, he potentially has positioned himself to become a prospective president of the United States.
Wow. That's interesting. So is his, I'm trying to think of the way to put it, his apparent representation of mainstream America, soccer moms and the SUVs defending kids, is this all for show, or is this who he really is?
I can't really, you know what's in his heart. He may truly, you know, care about those people, but the tribal interests are really they're so tied into the international crime syndicate, the Rothschilds, the Vatican, these different special interests who are betraying the soccer moms, are betraying the middle class. They are largely responsible for, you know, the increase in real estate values and the higher real estate taxes and making real estate more unaffordable for the average person. They are behind the Green New Deal, you know, which is making our natural resources, gas, for example, a lot more unaffordable for the average person. They're subsidizing, a free university for minorities and immigrants at the taxpayer's expense, while the average American is struggling to send their own children to school. And they have partnered with defense contractors who have spurred a number of wars that are not in the national interest, but in which have generated a tremendous amount of debt for the average person. So I think if you look at the big picture, I would say that he is not serving the interests of, you know, the average middle class person or the soccer mom.
So he's focusing on a popular issue that'll promote him. You know who you make him sound like? Glenn Youngkin.
Exactly.
Do you agree with
exactly
that?
Exactly right. I do. Like they corral people around these issues that will elicit a strong emotional reaction from people, like transgender in politics or being forced to wear masks in schools. But in the larger scheme of things, those are such minor issues when you look at, you know, what these elites are doing to the country on a national level, you know, within, you know, our banks and governments and so forth.
My goodness. I never thought I'd make that comparison today in this interview between Youngkin and DeSantis. All right, so do you agree he's White House bound in his mind?
I do. And to kind of deepen the comparison between DeSantis and Youngkin, one of the seminal tribe of Florida's tribal councils is Greenberg Traurig. And you may not remember Greenberg Traurig, but they represented Bush Cheney in its contest for Florida's electoral votes back in the 1999-2000 election.
Hanging chads.
That's correct. And they did this working alongside Jim Baker, who is a major investor in the Carlyle Group. So you're really looking at the same nexus of interest around DeSantis and Youngkin. Like the same type of, you know, financial interests are backing both of them.
Neocon?
Youngkin and DeSantis.
Yeah, but I'm saying, would neocon be a fair descriptor?
Yes, it would be. Yes, it would be.
Boy, you're taking the sail out, because DeSantis is someone I've kind of liked. Yeah, I've liked him, but what you're saying makes perfect sense. All right, let's shift gears, and I'm sure we'll find a way to return to DeSantis, but I have done, well, a public presentation in which she got mentioned, 7 YouTube videos, and an article. And Tulsi Gabbard's a gun grabber, full abortion supporter. Every liberal issue she's behind, so it seems, in her past. And now all of a sudden we're supposed to believe she's had this transformation of being a constitutionally loving politician. I don't trust her. I see her as a Trojan horse. How do you see her?
I agree with you on that. Now, Tulsi Gabbard is also a Hindu. She was the daughter of a Roman Catholic, but she's also a confirmed Hindu. And the reason that might be important is that Hinduism and Buddhism are the religions of the occult, or of the ruling elite. So this is, you know, it is something to take note of, that she was a keynote speaker at CPAC, which is a group centered around traditional Judeo-Christian conservative values. You know, bringing a Hindu to that platform to speak about God and country is, you know, it's interesting. She appears to be a Zionist. I know that she has kind of championed Israeli interests, and my view is that the stance that she has taken on the Ukraine, which has aligned with Russia, reflects the fact that she is supporting the Russia Israeli China alliance against the United States. And I don't necessarily agree with what we are doing in the Ukraine. I don't think we have any strategic interest there. I know we've got our own corruption issues, and that we did stage a coup d'etat in the Ukraine, which appears to be, you know, a center of a lot of mafia and criminal activity. But the position that Tulsi Gabbard has taken is in line with the Zionist position. So it would appear that she is Israel first and not American first, or America first.
I didn't go down the Zionist path with her. I don't know if you... I forget the name of the guy who runs CPAC, but Paul Preston told me, and he's been pretty public about it on his show, that the head of CPAC received $183,000 from George Soros to let Tulsi Gabbard speak. You weren't aware of that?
Yeah. I was not aware of that. Does not surprise me. And I think that Google is also now a sponsor of CPAC.
Yeah, they are. And so they've told you everything we need to know.
that it has become an establishment operation.
Yeah, it is so typical to basically control your opposition by owning it.
And unfortunately, they have done that. I mean, it's a shame because I've always admired and liked Tulsi Gabbard. She has supported and endorsed Bernie Sanders, who's a communist. And I don't know how you can go from that to suddenly being a strict constitutionalist.
Yeah, she gave a speech at She gave a speech at CPAC that I listened to, 20-some minutes long, and it was a speech that a senior in high school would give in their government class about the virtues of the Constitution and the First Amendment. It had no depth for a politician, no application.
So somebody possibly wrote it for her. The reason I mentioned, you know, her background as a Hindu is that Hinduism and Buddhism were the basis of the Rational Enlightenment, and within the Rational Enlightenment, the ideology behind it is that you should that integrity is not important. You know, the standard Judeo-Christian ethos is that, you know, you speak your truth, you operate with integrity, and within the national interest, and within, you know, of course, interest of your family, but you're ultimately serving God, who is the Word, who's the truth. Within the Rational Enlightenment, to have integrity is to be weak and foolish. You'd want to align your position which would provide you with the greatest opportunity for wealth and power. And so I believe that is what she has done, that she is revealing herself not to have any principles. She's a person who is maybe a political opportunist, and she is seeing that her interests are better aligned by aligning with the Zionists. So you're seeing that, you know, she is providing the standard talking points in her speeches. And I believe that Hillary Clinton had also identified her as a possible renegade who would run on a third-party ticket for the presidency. So she may be somebody who would split the vote, you know, between the Republicans and Democrats, you know, in a presidential run. And she would be appealing to those issues that would resonate with the average American. You know, they would think that she is on their side, but really, you know, she is, of course, another establishment candidate.
It's funny you'd say this. How coincidental, or how observational, both of us. Since October, September, I've been saying, Tulsi Gabbard, watch her. She's going to form a third party. Her mission is to split the Republican vote, just like the 1912 election with Taft and Roosevelt versus Wilson. And Wilson ends up being president, very improbable president. And I said that I think this is her mission. What made you arrive at that conclusion?
I think what Hillary Clinton arrived at it before me, but also the fact that she is portraying herself as a reformer, and typically, she reminded me of Ross Perot and other third party candidates who've done the same.
Bingo. We didn't even talk about this, and we're walking down the same path right now with Tulsi Gabbard. This is why I call her America's great Trojan horse. That's my name for her.
I agree with that. I agree with that characterization.
My goodness gracious here. This interview right here, folks, I don't have to go any further. This is worth the price of admission. Do not be sucked in by Tulsi Gabbard. You don't go from being pro post-term abortion, gun confiscation, to espousing the First Amendment before CPAC. Sorry, I'm not buying it.
No, I completely agree with you. It's very interesting. I mean, she was a card-carrying liberal, you know, up until when did she change her position and become?
I'm going to say in the last 8 or 9 months.
And I think this was after she endorsed Joe Biden. And then maybe she saw that the Democrats were falling out of favor and thought she would maybe align herself with Republicans, I guess. But
she's not Biden's friend now.
No, she's not.
You know, there's a side issue I want to bring up with you, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
It's Fox News, particularly Tucker Carlson, but Fox News has her on that I see once or twice a week, and that's just when I catch her. She's inundating this so-called masquerading conservative news outlet, pro-America. And here she is talking about the evils of the Biden administration and the Democratic Party as a whole. And interesting, though, Tucker asked her a few months ago, he says, are you still a Democrat? And she didn't answer the question.
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting. But here's the other thing that bothers me, too. Tucker Carlson has done a segment on voter fraud in Wisconsin with an ex-Supreme Court justice from that state who said there's five counties we can definitely prove voter fraud in. The Speaker of the House there that will not let this come out in the open, he's blocking everything. But other than that, Fox doesn't touch this topic at all. They hit the issue of vaccine, but they don't really get into how bad the vaccine is for individual health. Fox News, controlled opposition, and Tulsi Gabbard is, shall we say, their minion that they've been told to promote.
Correct. And I think Fox News is run by Rupert Murdoch, who was, I think according to British sources, he was a Mossad asset, you know, along with Robert Maxwell. So he's going to be promoting the Zionist line, and I believe that Tulsi Gabbard is a Zionist at this point.
Gosh, I hope a lot of people hear this interview. This was worth the price of admission right here. I mean, this is something I've been carrying around. Dave, why are you so hard on Tulsi Gabbard? Because every time she comes on Fox and speaks to the lies, I know she's lying about who she, what she believes, I call her out. I do it every single time I see her. And why are you so obsessed with Tulsi? Well, now you know why. She's going to make it possible for the Democrats to retain power if we don't expose her for what she is.
But she is a very articulate and presentable candidate. I think she does have a good chance of winning, potentially, or at least, you know, splitting the vote.
I see her as a 20% vote getter, but that's all you'd need. But I will say this. Had Ross Perot not quit for that real bogus my daughter's wedding nonsense excuse, he would have won the election. He was big time. He had a double-digit lead. He had a double-digit lead over Bush and Clinton. And it's kind of like, okay, Ross, you were supposed to do this, but you're doing it a little bit too well. And he really hooked people in with NAFTA. Tulsi's big hook is freedom of speech, constitutional liberty, big tech is bad. That's her mantra right now. But I look at this and I'm thinking, if the Republicans don't get someone who's in good stead, she could possibly win.
She could. And remember that, you know, Cambridge Analytica exposed, or the, I guess that the controversy surrounding Cambridge Analytica revealed that our political elites are monitoring social media. They're trying to determine, you know, what values, what issues and ideas are the people going to rally around. And I think they have a good idea of where people stand, and they have, you know, compiled talking points that they're giving to their prospective candidates. I think Tulsi Gabbard, you know, is speaking to those issues.
Hmm.
You know, as if they were her own.
Is there anybody out there at all that comes to your mind that you say is not owned by the establishment and they really are their own person? Or is that just a myth that can never happen?
Well, I think you're definitely one of them.
but I'm not in politics.
You're not in politics. That's a good question. I would really need to think about that. I know that you had mentioned Elon Musk before we started the show. And I think that Elon Musk could potentially run on the Republican side.
Yes.
I think he's a very attractive candidate. He's, you know, a billionaire who is taking on you know, the technocratic elite, but he was essentially created by them, and he, you know, his companies were subsidized, you know, by the government. He's a member of the Royal Society of London, so he is essentially advancing the, you know, the agenda that the elites have set out for him. But I think that he would have a fairly good chance of winning the Republican nomination.
Yeah, it's interesting you'd say that. We were in Dallas for a conference I was doing, and so Monday we're on our way to the rental car return, and we're in Dallas, and we drive by the monument of California failure, a Tesla plant. We drove right by a Tesla plant in Dallas near Love Field. And I thought, that's the great testament to the failure of the Democratic Party in California. But then I started thinking, hold on. And this is where I had kind of an epiphany. I could see Musk challenging Trump for the nomination in 2024.
I can see that. And I think he would win if he were to do so. I believe that the Tesla plant was brought in by Ted Cruz, wasn't it?
He was a party in helping. You know, the extent of his involvement, I'm not sure. But I do know publicly he came out against it and used it to criticize the Democrats and Nancy Pelosi in California.
Interesting.
But see, I'm not a believer in Ted Cruz either. And a lot of people are talking about him as a populist candidate. And let me tell you why I say no. First of all, his conduct in the 2016 election, he acted like an establishment figure. And he had a lot of the neocon beliefs. But even more than that, his wife, Heidi, member of Goldman Sachs and sits on the Council of Foreign Relations.
And I think he was created by George W. Bush. He came into politics as an advisor for him, if I'm not mistaken. I think then he became Solicitor General of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So he owes his career to Bush. And you know, Bush is as establishment as you can get. I see Ted Cruz as somebody who does a lot of grandstanding. I think he talks to the populist issues, but I think at heart, you know, he is advancing the agenda of the elite.
That's my feeling, too. And he couldn't stay married to Heidi if it was any other way.
True.
Yeah, I've never trusted Ted Cruz, although I find myself rooting for him many times when he speaks. But you're right. It's all show and no go. He's Tulsi Gabbard in Republican clothing.
Unfortunately, you know, we have to remove the overarching influence of money in politics because campaign finance is the lifeblood of our campaigns, and so our politicians are almost required to speak to those issues and to champion those issues. From those sources which give them money, and of course the deepest pockets are associated with the major investment banks, multinationals, and you know the technocratic elite. So it's if they want to win, you know, an election, go ahead.
I was going to say it's almost like you're eavesdropping on my conversations. I have said that we need to unelect Republican incumbents in the primary. Get new blood in, and maybe it'll make a difference, maybe it won't, but assuming it could, the first thing they need to do when they get to Congress is to outlaw campaign contributions in any form.
I agree.
And I think all elections with qualifying electorates, they should be publicly funded because that way you keep the corporations from buying the election, at least overtly.
And we would need our media to be honest and to allow them to do their due diligence, to provide platforms for these candidates and to properly vet them. But of course, you know, our main mainstream media are owned by these multinationals who have business before Capitol Hill. So they are also pouring money into the political process, and they have a vested interest in electing establishment candidates and not properly vetting them. You know, because they want to make sure that their interests, you know, are properly served.
Yeah, I want to get your reaction to something that happened in Texas a little over a week ago. They had a primary for the retention of 10 judges, Democrats. Mm-hmm. So it was Democrats voting for Democrats, no Republican influence. And the Democrats rejected all 10 incumbent judges.
Interesting.
Do you read anything into that? And that was in Harris County, by the way, outside of Houston.
That's interesting. Now, I know that back in 2013, I know this is, again, citing, you know, Anna Von Wright. I know she's somewhat of a controversial figure. She's the common law judge in Alaska. She said that as of 2013, our attorneys, you know, who have to be registered by the American Bar Association, which is ultimately controlled by the Crown Temple in London, the City of London, that as of 2013, they no longer have to serve the British elite, you know, the Temple Bar. So they are free to actually rule according to the Constitution and rule in the interests of, you know, of we the people. So I don't know if changes within the courts are somehow affecting judges, or if judges are choosing to resign, if they're bringing in new people, or I know that George Soros has, you know, bankrolled a number of these judges, but I think that there are a lot of changes going on behind the scenes, you know, that we're not entirely aware of, like a changing of the guard, if you will.
In terms of what candidates get promoted?
In terms of, I think there are judges who've been bought and paid for. I think that their level of compromise is known. I think that some of those judges may be stepping aside. And I don't know that whether that the new candidates will be will rule with more integrity, or if they're bringing in a new group of candidates who will then rule it according to the new special interests, or according to the new game plan that they have set up.
Very interesting. That's well, that's really an astute observation. It truly is. It is a move towards populism, I think, what I saw.
I hope you're right.
These judges, but we have Dominion voting machines and corrupt officials, and you talked about the judges who are compromised. Well, you know what I've told you about Arizona election and what I found out about our loyalty of our officials. The entire governor and his establishment and the elected officials, senior elected officials in Arizona, down to the county prosecutors, down to the county clerk and recorders, they're all controlled by George Soros or China. All of them.
That's a problem.
And it's easy to prove. Okay, I'll give you one example here. Jack Sellers, who was at the time of the election, was the head of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. And the Gateway Pundit published much of the same stuff I did. He was the go-to guy who brought in Chinese businesses, which is the CCP, because they're not separate. And he brought in Chinese businesses to every suburb, the city of Phoenix, all the state universities, all the utility companies, and most of the major Fortune 500 corporations that are headquartered in Arizona. And I'm thinking, you basically have China owning our infrastructure.
Correct. Well, let me ask you this. I know that you don't like to get into like QAnon territory, but there was a fellow by the name of Russell J. Gould who claimed that he stole or he seized the American flag back in 1999. Do you know anything about that?
No.
Okay, he was stating that based upon what he did, that going forward, we could never hold another election, because he said that once he accomplished that, the Constitution in the United States was rendered null and void. And I think there's also an issue with Nocera, that based upon the discoveries of that class action, like with in which the banks illegally foreclosed upon the farmers, this was a class action that was the basis of Nocera, that there were the fraud within the international banking system was exposed. And that the elites, in order to kind of cover their bases, to compensate themselves and others who they had wronged, they began to sell off America's assets, like our infrastructure, our roads, so forth, ports, airports. either Saudi Arabia, China, and that began, I think, you know, in concert with the Nasera lawsuits.
I don't have a direct response to that. I do have an indirect response that weighs very closely to what you're talking about. I wrote an article, actually, I covered it twice, Underground Mineral Assets in America. And it, I don't remember the exact amount. I have to go back and look at the figures, and they will change certainly because of inflation. But effectively, we could pay off our national debt several times over with our underground wealth.
And I agree.
When I looked at everything that was there, I said, the only thing preventing this from happening is basically China bought our debt. And I made the point at this time, this was pre-Trump when I first wrote this. I said, you can't satisfy Chinese creditors if you're selling off their future assets.
Oh, interesting.
See, I really believe the Wei Fang speech. And this speech was leaked too widely. I was one of the first ones to get it, so I kind of thought, I'm out on a limb a little bit, but I'm going to go with it. But since that time, this has been validated. Wei Fang was the same as the two previous defense ministers in that he called for genocide against the American people for the purposes of national occupation here, sending 300 million colonists here, and we're the only country that can materialistically satisfy their resource needs. And they want us out. And they Wei Fang specifically mentioned the use of bio-specific race weapons developed in conjunction with Israel. And the Chinese nationals that are here, 14 million of them would be spared. That's in his speech. This is not someone told somebody who told me. This is directly what he said to the CCP in the speech that was transcribed and leaked.
I remember something along those lines, that they want to cleanse America of hundreds of millions of people. I think we have 300 million people living here or so, because yeah, you're right that North America has the land space and the resources that they need. I think that our corporations have polluted their landscape, but they want, you know, they want our kind of relatively clean environment, and they want to tap the resources. But I think, according to Anna von Reitz, we have more than paid our debt. In fact, we are a creditor nation. You know, she said that if you were to balance the books within the Fed, that they're not lodging our credits, that they're trying to make it appear as though we are in debt, but we're actually a creditor nation, and that since we are a creditor nation, China would not be able to take possession of North America.
Interesting. Has, well, at least not legally.
Attempted to make that case. At least not legally, correct.
At least not legally, yeah. Not legally. I hear you. Well, we're almost out of time, and this is so fascinating. I mean, I could go on like this for hours because we've covered so much valuable territory. But we got to let the audience know how they can follow your good works. So let me just say this, too. As you come across things you think are interesting and would be of this kind of value to our audience, I don't hesitate to contact me. We'll get you back on the air.
Oh, will do. Thank you for that.
So anyway, tell us about your work and how people can follow you.
Okay, thank you. I've written a number of books kind of exposing or at least trying to educate the people about the deep state and their machinations, how we got to the position where we are so that we can find our way back and take back our country. And you can find my books on my website, which is www.susanbradford.org. You can contact me there. There's a little information on my background, a few articles, and I always enjoy hearing, you know, from the audience. You're welcome to contact me as well.
Would you say that you had a transformation from either knowingly or unknowingly being part of the establishment to what you do now, which is basically reform work?
I think I always was a person who championed integrity and clean government. I had no idea how corrupt the government actually was.
Bingo.
But once I became aware of what we were up against and what our elites were doing against the people, I really had no choice, you know, but to be a champion of the people. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
And see, I went through a similar transformation. I can completely identify. You get into something and it looks all professional at the top. But as you delve into the depth, then you start to realize it's not as it appears to be. I've been there. We'll
Correct.
Have to talk about that another time because I'll share with you some things. Anyway, we are flat out of time, Susan. This was fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on the Common
thank
Sense
you.
Show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take care.
You too.